Chapter 20. The King of the Rebu. The offer that Amuba had made through Jethro was a politic one, and he was influenced by two motives in granting a delay of 24 hours before receiving his answer. In the first place, he felt sure that before the conclusion of that time, his own force would be trebled in strength. Then, should the Egyptians refuse, he would be able to repel any efforts they might make to cut their way out. In the second place, he thought that the Egyptian answer, if given at once, would probably be a refusal. But the time for reflection would enable them to look their position in the face and to recognize its hopelessness. On the one side would be certain defeat and death. On the other, their general would lead out his command intact and without dishonor. Although Amuba had threatened to put the garrison to the sword in case they refused, he had no intention to carry out his threat. He knew the proud and haughty nature of the Egyptians, and that the news of the massacre of a great garrison and the successful rising of a tributary province would excite such deep feeling that sooner or later an army would be dispatched to avenge the disaster. If, however, the garrison left the country with their arms and standards, no disgrace would be inflicted upon the national arms, and as a tribute, however much reduced, would still be paid, they could still regard the Rebu as under their domination. Leaving Jethro in command of the force, Amuba, accompanied by Kebron and a small bodyguard, went back into the town. The news of his coming had already spread, and the inhabitants poured out into the streets. As Amuba approached, a deafening shout of welcome was raised. The gates of the prisons had been thrown open, and those arrested the previous day, and many others of the principal captains of his father's army, thronged round him and greeted him as their king. With difficulty, a way was cleared to the gate of the royal enclosure. Amuba, after entering, mounted the wall and addressed the people. He told them that, in defiance of all probability, he had escaped from his captivity in Egypt and made his way back to his native land, intent not so much on claiming his rightful position there as of freeing them from the power of their oppressors. He promised them that he would always respect their rights and usages and should endeavor to follow in the footsteps of his father. Then he retired to the palace, where he held a council with the captains and leading men in the city. Orders were at once issued for every man capable of bearing arms to provide himself with some kind of weapon and to assemble at noon in the great square. Lists were drawn up of all the officers of the late army still living in the town, and when the gathering took place at noon, these were appointed to form the men into companies, to appoint sub-officers, and to see to the state of the arms. A larger proportion than was expected of the 3,000 men that assembled were found to be provided with weapons. Although nominally all arms had been surrendered to the Egyptians, great numbers of spear and arrowheads, swords, and axes had been buried. Shafts had been hastily made for the spears, and bows used for the purposes of the chase were now brought out to do service as fighting weapons. Many hundreds of spears and swords had been found in the stores at the palace, and when these were served out, most of the men had a weapon of some sort. They were at once marched up to the Egyptian enclosure. Those with bows and arrows were placed upon the walls. The rest were massed near the gate in readiness to advance to the assistance of the band within, should the Egyptians make an attempt to cut their way out. In point of numbers, Amuba's forces were now superior to those of the Egyptians, but he was well aware that the superior arms and discipline of the latter would enable them to make a successful sortie should they determine to do so. By noon, the contingents from the towns began arriving in regular order, while the shepherds and villagers straggled in irregularly as the news reached them. By evening, fully 10,000 men had arrived. The troops remained under arms all night, ready to repel an attack, and in the morning, Amuba and Jethro mounted together onto the terrace of the building from which the parley had taken place on the previous day. A few minutes later, the Egyptian governor and a group of his officers appeared on the opposite house. Jethro called in a loud voice, "This is King Amuba. He is here to confirm the terms offered yesterday and to receive your answer." The Egyptian governor replied,
"We are ready to retire beyond your frontier, carrying with us our arms, standards, and valuables. It being understood that we make no surrender whatever, but that we march out on equal terms, believing as we do that we could, if we chose, cut our way out in spite of any resistance."
Then Amuba spoke, and the Egyptian was astonished at finding that the king, as well as his general, was capable of conversing in the Egyptian tongue.
"You may hold that belief," Amuba said. "And indeed, knowing and honoring the valor of the Egyptian troops, I admit it is possible that with great loss you might make your way out. But more than that you could not do. You could not hold the country, and it is doubtful whether you could reach the frontier. Surely it is better, then, that you should leave with honor and without loss."
After a pause, the Egyptian commander continued,
"As to the tribute you offer, I have no power to agree to diminish the terms imposed by our king. And if it be his will that an army invades your country to enforce the former terms, I, with the troops here, must march as ordered without imputation of having behaved treacherously."
"That is quite understood," Amuba said. "But I trust, my lord, that you, having seen for yourself how poor is our country, how unable to continue to pay the tribute formerly demanded from us, which has already impoverished us, will represent the same in your dispatches to the king, and will use your good offices in obtaining his favorable consideration of our case. I can promise you the tribute shall be paid regularly. I regard Egypt as the greatest power in the world. I am most desirous to continue in friendly relations with it, and I swear to you it will be no fault of mine if any complaint reaches you of trouble on our part."
Amuba's speech was well calculated to soothe the pride of the Egyptian. The latter was perfectly conscious, although he spoke confidently, that it would be no easy matter for his troops to cut their way through the narrow gateway held by the masses of the Ribu, still less to make their way to their frontier. If he returned with his troops intact and in good condition, he could so represent circumstances that no blame or discredit would fall upon him. He therefore agreed to the terms Amuba proposed. After a short parley, the conditions of the evacuation of the town by the Egyptians were arranged. Amuba agreed to withdraw his men from the buildings that they occupied, and also from the gate, and to place them all upon the walls, thus saving the Egyptians the humiliation of passing through lines of armed men, and avoiding the risk of a broil arising between the soldiers. The inhabitants of the city, meanwhile, were all ordered back from the road leading to the gate in the city walls. An hour later, in firm and steady order, the Egyptians marched out. The images and symbols of the gods were carried aloft, and the bearing of the soldiers was proud and defiant, for they were doubtful whether the Ribu might not intend to make an attack upon them, the terms granted them seeming to be almost too good to be trusted. No sooner had the rear of the column passed out through the city gate than the Ribu, with shouts of joy, flocked down from the walls, and the city gave itself up to rejoicing. For the next few days, Amuba's time was wholly occupied in receiving deputations from the various towns and districts, in appointing fresh officials, and in taking measures for the rearming of the people and their enrollment in companies, so that the country should be in a position to offer resistance should the Egyptians determine to recapture it. He had, on the very night of the surprise of the town, sent on a message to inform Maisa and Ruth of his success, and that neither Kebron, Jethro, nor himself was hurt. Having got through his most pressing business, he left Jethro, who was now formally appointed general-in-chief, to carry on the work. And then Amuba started with Kebron to fetch the young women to his capital. But he was now obliged to travel with a certain amount of state, accompanied by 20 of the leading men of the Ribu in chariots, and by an escort of lightly armed horsemen. At each town He was hailed as king and deliverer of the nation. 2 days after starting, he arrived at the little seaport and made his way to the house of the Persian merchant where he had placed Maissa and Ruth. After a word or two with him, Amuba and Kebron entered the house and ascended to the apartment which had been set aside for them. Ruth and Maissa were standing timidly at one end of the room, and both bent profoundly as he entered. For a moment Amuba paused in astonishment. Then he burst into a fit of laughter. "Is this your sister, Kebron, who thus greets her old friend in such respectful fashion? Am I myself or someone else?"
"You are King Amuba," Maissa said.
"That is true enough, Maissa. But I was always a prince, you know, so there is nothing very surprising in that."
"There is a great difference, and it is only right where there is such a difference of rank."
"The difference of rank need not exist long, Maissa," Amuba said, stepping forward and taking her hand. "Kebron, who is your brother, and like a brother to me, has given me his consent, and it rests only with you whether you will be queen of the Ribu and Amuba's wife. If I had not succeeded in winning a throne, I should have asked you to share my lot as an exile. Surely you're not going to spoil my triumph now by saying no." And Maissa did not say no. 6 weeks later, there was a royal wedding in the capital. The wedding was celebrated in great state, though it was observed that Amuba abstained from himself offering sacrifice on the altars of the gods. And the ceremony was a double one, for at the same time Kebron was united to Ruth. During the next year, the Ribu army was got into a state of great efficiency. As they had hoped, however, Egypt made no effort to regain her distant conquest and was content to accept the diminished tribute. So Amuba turned his attention to the internal affairs of the country, and contentment and plenty reigned in the land. Kebron remained Amuba's chief minister, advisor, and friend. And under their joint efforts, the Ribu rose from the condition of a mere settled tribe to that of a small but flourishing nation. And another change was made, but more slowly. Soon after his ascension, Amuba assembled many of the leading men and chief priests in the country and explained to them the convictions held by himself and Kebron and their wives that there was but one God who ruled over the world. He explained to the priests that he did not wish to overthrow the temples or disturb the worship of the former gods, and he said he had no thought of enforcing his convictions upon others, but that all would be free to worship as they pleased. In this matter alone, Amuba met with much opposition in carrying out his plans, and had he been less popular than he was with the people, his efforts might have cost him his throne and his life. But the Ribu were devoted to him, and as the priests came gradually to see that the change would not diminish their power, their opposition died away, and especially as many of the younger men were soon convinced by the arguments of the king and his minister, and preached the new religion with enthusiasm among the people. And Amuba was well aware that the success of the work was to no small extent due to the earnestness with which Maissa and Ruth labored among the wives and daughters of the nobles. One day, 10 years after their arrival in the land, when the little party who had traveled so long together were gathered in a room in the palace, Kebron said, "How strangely things turn out. At one time it seemed that unlucky shot of mine would not only bring ruin on all connected with me, but be a source of unhappiness to me to the end of my life. Now I see that, except for the death of my father, it was the most fortunate event of my life. Otherwise I should have all my life gone on believing in the gods of Egypt. And although you, Amuba and Jethro, might one day have made your escape, Maissa and Ruth and I would assuredly never have left Egypt, never have known anything of the life of happiness and usefulness that we now enjoy.
All this I consider we owe to the fortunate shot that killed the cat of Bubastes.